Welcome to the Deep Dive. I'm Lee Graham, and today we are, well, we're taking on a massive mission. We're cracking open an incredibly dense and I think very revealing snapshot of where we are right now, both globally and domestically. All of it is drawn directly from the contents of the Washington Post for Sunday, November 23rd, 2025.
And I'm Sam Hurst, and you're right. This edition is, it's exhausting, but, you know, in the best possible way. We've got this remarkable collection of just high-stakes conflicts. We're talking legally audacious, lethal strikes in the Caribbean, all the way to constitutional crises that are unfolding in our own courtrooms. We'll be tracking economic policy shifts, major institutional failures, and some really profound cultural insights.
That's right. And our goal here is to really extract the absolute essential knowledge nuggets for you, the insights, the context, the long-term implications that you need to know, without, you know, drowning in all the data. We want to give you the shortcut to being comprehensively well-informed. There is a tremendous amount to unpack, so let's just jump straight in. First up, and this is arguably the most consequential section, global pressure points and national security escalations. And we have to start with these incredibly controversial military actions being taken right now.
We really do. We have to begin with this escalation of U.S. executive power in the pursuit of drug traffickers. What we're detailing is the Trump administration's policy of conducting lethal strikes against alleged drug traffickers in the Caribbean Sea and the Eastern Pacific. The whole campaign is operating under the banner of Operation Southern Spear.
And when you look at the core action, the sheer scope of this is, well, it's stunning. In just the last 10 months, the administration has used U.S. military force, we're often talking special operators, and it's resulted in over 80 deaths across 21 boat strikes, all targeting narcotics traffic.
It's a huge escalation of military engagement in the Western Hemisphere, and it was pushed hard by the administration almost as soon as they took office this year.
Okay, so what makes this more than just a military story is the internal legal drama. The White House has been, it seems, repeatedly steamrolling or just removing internal legal skepticism from career officials.
That's exactly right. You have lawyers across the CIA, the National Security Council, the NSC, and the Defense Department raising these critical concerns about the legality and just the propriety of these strikes.
So what were those critical legal concerns? What's the core of the disagreement?
Well, it really boils down to this profound question about the separation of powers and, you know, the laws of war. The career lawyers were basically asking, how is it defensible under our own domestic law to kill civilian drug traffickers, especially if there's no immediate intelligence saying these cartels are actively trying to attack Americans?
Right. And how can you legally justify lethal force against people you haven't even positively identified? I mean, many of them are probably low-level operators.
Exactly. You are essentially applying battlefield rules to what is, at its heart, a law enforcement problem.
And that internal conflict, that led to a pretty dramatic shakeup at the NSC.
Oh, a huge one. The entire full-time legal staff, we're talking about half a dozen people, they all departed. And this exodus included the shop's top lawyer, former Pentagon General Counsel Paul Ney, who had been one of the most vocal in raising these concerns.
And the administration's public line on this.
Yeah.
How did they frame this institutional gutting?
They tried to frame it as a move toward greater efficiency. They argued that consolidating legal advice would give the president better visibility on national security law.
An explanation that just isn't holding up under scrutiny at all.
No, not at all. And what's fascinating here is the implication. National security experts are sounding the alarm. They're arguing this absence means the White House is just not getting the best, most impartial national security legal advice.
So they're removing the internal dissent.
Pretty much. Carrie Cordero, a lawyer with experience in previous administrations, she noted that stripping this institutional capacity ensures that the White House is advised only by those who are willing to just rubber stamp predetermined policies. This is a story about maximizing executive power by purging skepticism.
Okay, so if the career lawyers are gone or dissenting, how did the administration legally justify the strikes? They needed some kind of legal backbone for this.
They did, and they found it in the Office of Legal Counsel, the OLC, which is essentially the top lawyer shop within the Justice Department that provides the legal framework for presidential actions.
And what did they produce?
The OLC delivered a classified opinion, dozens of pages long, that asserted the legal basis for the strikes. And they did it by using a kind of legal sleight of hand. They claim the U.S. is in an armed conflict with narco-terrorists.
And that's the key phrase right there, isn't it? Narco-terrorists.
It's everything. If the executive branch can unilaterally declare a global armed conflict, even a non-international one, against some amorphous group like narco-terrorists, it just creates a massive precedent.
It allows them to bypass the constitutional requirement for Congress to authorize a war.
Precisely. It blurs the lines between military action and global law enforcement to a degree we really haven't seen before.
And this new framing was then passed down to the military.
Right. That reportedly happened in August. And soon after, in early September, special operators struck a boat. They were targeting alleged Trinidadagua narco-terrorists. And the administration specifically claimed this Venezuelan gang was operating under the control of Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro, which directly ties the drug war to a geopolitical opponent.
But the factual basis for that claim, it's heavily disputed, isn't it?
It is. Family members of the 11 people killed in that specific strike, they denied any affiliation with the gang, Trinidadagua. Though two did admit they were smuggling marijuana and cocaine.
And more importantly.
More importantly, U.S. intelligence agencies themselves have concluded that the Venezuelan government does not direct the group.
So the U.S. is justifying lethal military force by claiming this political necessity tied to Maduro.
But its own intelligence completely undercuts that very claim. So this policy is clearly part of a much broader, intensified campaign against Maduro. And we're seeing other moves that underscore that escalation.
Absolutely. The Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA, has issued this stark warning to commercial pilots. They're advising them to exercise caution over Venezuelan airspace because of the worsening security situation and heightened military activity.
And that includes the significant U.S. naval presence, like the arrival of the massive USS Gerald R. Ford aircraft carrier strike group in the Caribbean just this month.
And they're warning about more than just ships.
Yeah, they also specifically warned about increased reports of interference jammers and spoofers that are affecting satellite navigation data for commercial flights near Venezuela. And these effects can extend for hundreds of miles, which raises the risk profile significantly.
And you couple that with the Venezuelan military having advanced fighter jets and capable weapons, the FAA is basically saying this airspace is now a serious hazard zone.
It is. And on the diplomatic and psychological front, the White House has proposed an escalation that falls just short of a direct military attack, a pretty significant psychological operation, a PSYOP involving dropping leaflets over Caracas.
This is textbook stuff.
It's textbook psychological warfare. It's designed to undermine and demoralize the enemy leadership and the populace. The proposed leaflets would remind citizens of the hefty $50 million U.S. bounty on Maduro's head.
And timing is particularly pointed.
Very. Officials were reportedly timing the drop to coincide with Maduro's 63rd birthday, which is this Sunday.
Dropping leaflets. It has a long history. It's often used to soften up a target population before a major conflict, like the U.S. did before the 2003 invasion of Iraq.
Exactly. It's a clear signal of the administration's willingness to exert immense pressure. And it's overseeing air campaigns in multiple theaters, Yemen, Iran, the Caribbean, all while maintaining this political platform of avoiding new foreign military engagements.
So let's move geographically now to Eastern Europe, where we find President Zelensky of Ukraine facing what sounds like an existential crisis compounded by, well, internal rot.
Yeah, the Washington Post describes the situation as a stunning challenge. He's facing these major corruption allegations that are rocking his inner circle at the precise moment he needs maximum national unity.
And the outrage at home must be visceral.
It is. The ruling elite are allegedly profiting, gaining wealth, opportunities, while ordinary Ukrainians are suffering through daily blackouts, relentless Russian missile attacks, and just the misery of war. This scandal has really laid bare the limits of that wartime social contract that requires unity above all else.
And this internal weakness is, of course, being exploited externally.
Of course. Simultaneously, Washington, specifically President Trump, is ramping up pressure on Zelensky to accept what everyone is calling an unfavorable peace deal based on Trump's extensive 28-point plan.
Which puts Zelensky in an absolutely impossible position domestically.
Ooh, totally. If he accepts this U.S.-backed peace deal, observers say it risks the very independence that Ukrainians are fighting and dying for. Domestic resistance would be almost certain.
And opposition lawmakers are capitalizing on the corruption scandal.
They are. They're openly demanding a cleaning of government and system changes, and specifically urging Zelensky to dismiss key officials close to him, like Andriy Yermak.
Now, the details of this peace plan, they're so contentious that they're generating rare and very public Republican dissent here in the U.S.
That's right. We're talking about highly influential figures. Senators Lindsey Graham, Roger Wicker, and Mitch McConnell have all voiced strong opposition.
And Graham, in particular, pointed out that several areas of the proposal are deeply problematic.
He did. He stressed that any plan has to forcefully address the fate of the estimated 20,000 Ukrainian children allegedly kidnapped by Russian forces. Rewarding Russia while ignoring a state crime of that magnitude is just unacceptable to him.
And Senator Wicker, who chairs the Senate Armed Services Committee.
He was highly skeptical. He argued the plan should not reward Russian butchery or, critically, undermine long-term U.S. security interests in Europe. McConnell echoed this, calling the idea of rewarding Russia's aggression disastrous. This dissent just shows the immense internal fractures within the Republican Party on foreign policy, even as the president tries to dictate the outcome.
These global pressure points aren't just limited to state actors, though. Finally, let's turn to Nigeria, where mass kidnappings are creating some acute international tension.
That's right. Armed men on motorcycles kidnapped dozens of students, some as young as 6 years old, from a Catholic boarding school in Niger State in the Northwest. The estimates for how many children were taken range widely, from 50 to over 100.
And this incident comes at a really fraught moment in U.S.-Nigeria relations.
It does. Washington has been increasing pressure on Abuja to improve the protection of Christian communities, especially since this attack targeted a Catholic school.
But this is where the complexity of the security situation really demands a deeper look, right?
It does. Experts are emphasizing that framing this solely as a religious conflict is misleading and, frankly, counterproductive. Muslim communities are also frequently victimized, and a huge number of these attacks are not religiously motivated at all. They're driven purely by criminal gangs operating for ransom.
So these bandits are operating with impunity, and the crisis is more about a collapsing state security and organized crime than it is about sectarian violence alone.
Exactly. And that nuance makes any effective U.S. assistance very tricky. As one research analyst noted, Nigeria is already deeply divided along so many lines, and a heavy-handed American intervention focused only on protecting one religious group. Well, it carries a real risk of escalating the situation rather than stabilizing this widespread security crisis that's affecting everyone.
That shift from military engagements and geopolitical pressure brings us directly to the institutional crises right here at home, where legal and political turmoil are, you know, challenging the very foundations of government.
We are seeing a series of high-profile legal battles that, well, they appear strategically aimed at administration critics. First, let's look at the prosecution of the freshman Democrat, Representative LaMonica McIver of New Jersey.
Okay, so McIver is facing three counts: assaulting, resisting, and interfering with federal officers. These are serious charges, and they stem from a clash outside an ICE detention facility earlier this year.
Right, and she maintains she was conducting a routine congressional oversight visit that unfortunately spiraled into a heated protest during the attempted arrest of Newark Mayor Ross Baraka.
So the core legal defense her attorneys are mounting isn't just procedural, it's constitutional.
It is. They're arguing the charges are politically motivated and, critically, are protected by legislative immunity under the Constitution's speech or debate clause.
Okay, so here's the essential insight for you, the listener. The speech or debate clause is meant to protect members of Congress from executive or judicial harassment when they're performing their official duties. If the administration successfully prosecutes McIver for what she claims was congressional oversight, even if it involved loud criticism or just being near a protest, it fundamentally redefines and potentially narrows the scope of protected legislative work.
It would be a profound restriction on the ability of Congress to conduct aggressive oversight of the executive branch.
Yeah, McIver is facing a staggering legal risk here, up to 17 years in prison if she's convicted.
She is. She herself said, "I'm a mom, I'm a wife, I have a family, and I don't want to be in jail." Which really highlights the human toll of this unprecedented political friction.
And predictably, the entire Democratic caucus, including House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, has fully rallied behind her.
Yes, calling it a blatant attempt by the Trump administration to intimidate Congress.
And this isn't the only institutional mechanism being used against critics, is it?
Not at all. Simultaneously, the Pentagon has urged the House to investigate another prominent Democratic critic, Representative Eugene Vindman of Virginia, over alleged improper consulting work on behalf of Ukraine.
And the legal basis for this investigation urge relates to his status as a retired Army officer.
Correct. Under the law, retired Army officers have to get consent from both the U.S. Secretary of State and the Army Secretary before accepting employment that benefits a foreign government.
Vindman, who, of course, rose to prominence during the first impeachment process, he flatly denies the claim.
He does. He asserts that the revenue for his consulting firm came exclusively from American firms, not from the Ukrainian government, and that he strictly complied with all the regulations. He noted that he and his brother were acutely aware they would always be operating under a microscope.
And this investigation urge came right after Vindman led lawmakers in pressuring the White House to release a transcript of a call between Trump and the Saudi crown prince, suggesting, well, a pattern of political retaliation.
It does suggest that. Now, let's pivot to the Justice Department, where the case against the former FBI director, James Comey, has hit an astounding constitutional stumbling block.
This is maybe the most explosive domestic story in this whole edition. Prosecutors in the Comey case disclosed a potentially fatal procedural lapse. They never showed the final indictment to a fully constituted grand jury.
I mean, this is not a minor oversight. This is a failure of fundamental constitutional procedure under the Fifth Amendment, which requires that serious criminal charges proceed only after a grand jury review.
It suggests a breathtaking level of haste or...
Or perhaps political pressure, or just gross incompetence within a highly scrutinized Justice Department. The judge, U.S. District Judge Michael S. Nachmanoff, he immediately seized on this. He repeatedly drilled the assistant U.S. attorney for clarification on this fundamental error.
And the situation truly exploded when the judge started exploring the issue of political motivation. He asked Comey's attorney whether the interim U.S. attorney, Lindsey Halligan, was acting as a stalking horse or a puppet doing the president's bidding.
And the judge wasn't just insulting her casually. He was engaging in a legally relevant query about vindictive prosecution. This complex legal concept that challenges whether a prosecution is driven by legitimate law enforcement goals or by political retribution.
And the Justice Department's reaction to this was, I mean, it was unprecedented.
It was. Halligan and a DOJ spokesman immediately went on the offensive, attacking the presiding federal judge publicly, including on social media. They alleged the judge violated judicial canons by using the word puppet.
So the DOJ, rather than addressing the constitutional blunder or the judge's legitimate query, chose to attack the judiciary.
Yes, suggesting an attempt to shore up conservative media support for what was already an embattled and failing prosecution. It raises these immense dark questions about the politicization of the Justice Department's internal operations and the erosion of norms protecting judicial independence.
And still with the DOJ, they're also moving on this highly politicized matter regarding Jeffrey Epstein. Following a mandate signed by Congress, the Justice Department has requested a Florida federal court to unseal grand jury testimony related to the deceased financier.
Historically, courts are deeply reluctant to release grand jury testimony. They cite strict legal guidelines on secrecy that protect witnesses and the integrity of the process. But the DOJ is seeking an expedited ruling here, citing Congress's clear signed mandate to release all non-classified records.
And the political backdrop here is thick.
It's very thick. Trump had previously campaigned on the issue, using Epstein as an example of how corrupt elites operate. The White House insists Trump has consistently called for full transparency.
Meanwhile, Democratic lawmakers argue the president could have just directed the DOJ to release the records earlier without needing congressional urging or a court order, suggesting the delay was politically calculated.
Right, and this issue also played a role in the political rupture involving the resignation of Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, who had been fiercely pressing for the file's release.
Let's look at administrative controversies now, which serve as a stark reminder that political motivations often filter down into the practical denial of aid and resources. We're seeing clear signs of political targeting in the denial of FEMA disaster relief.
Yeah, the administration has repeatedly denied FEMA disaster relief for severe Illinois floods, and this policy follows previous denials for similar disasters in Western Maryland.
And officials in those Democrat-led jurisdictions, including Illinois Governor Pritzker, they strongly view these denials as politically driven punishment.
They do, and it's made worse by the fact that internal FEMA views from a veteran official who spoke anonymously suggested the severity of the Illinois storms met a reasonable threshold for approval.
So the decision was political, not based on a technical disaster assessment.
It appears so. And the human and financial cost of this denial is severe. The average cost burden on affected Illinois households is staggering. $16,784 statewide.
Wow.
And over half of the affected households reported significant issues like mold or sewage contamination. A disproportionate number of those affected are vulnerable populations, low-income, elderly, or disabled citizens. These denials are forcing immense financial hardship onto people in politically targeted areas.
And finally, on this front, the administration is using immigration rhetoric to focus political pressure on a specific population.
That's right. President Trump stated that temporary protected status, or TPS, for Minnesota Somalis will be canceled. And he explicitly linked this decision without any evidence to alleged Somali gangs and fraudulent money laundering activity in the state.
It's so crucial to contrast that highly incendiary political rhetoric with the actual factual data.
It is. TPS designation protects applicants from deportation due to dangerous conditions in their home country, like war or natural disaster. And Trump has a history of seeking to terminate TPS for multiple nationalities.
And the numbers just completely undermine the sweeping rhetoric aimed at the population in Minnesota.
They do. As of August, only 705 Somalis nationwide held TPS status. The Minnesota Attorney General called the threat a termination based on a bigoted whim and confirmed they're monitoring the situation and exploring legal options.
It's just a clear-cut example of prioritizing inflammatory political messaging over data-driven, fact-based policy concerning a relatively small specific population.
And the blending of these legal battles, the constitutional friction, and the administrative use of power for political punishment. Well, it forms the bridge to our next set of deep dives, the large-scale shifts in global economics, environment, and the public mood.
Right. So let's start with a major global policy failure. The UN climate talks, COP30, held in Belém, Brazil. They've concluded, and the outcome is being widely described as a profound defeat for global climate action, especially considering this is a decade after the Paris Agreement.
It really is. This outcome signals a decisive win for the oil, gas, and coal industries. Nearly 200 countries reached a final deal that completely rejected a binding roadmap to curtail the use of fossil fuels.
The very things that are the primary drivers of climate change.
Exactly. And this is what we need to unpack. The European Union, backed by several island nations, was the major holdout. They were pushing for specific time-bound commitments.
They wanted binding phase-down commitments and concrete timeline targets for fossil fuel reduction.
And when the final agreement came out, those critical mechanisms were entirely absent. You had German Chancellor Friedrich Merz and Brazilian President Lula da Silva there. But even after all-night negotiations, they just couldn't reach consensus on language to phase out fossil fuels.
So the EU Climate Commissioner reluctantly agreed to support the weaker accord.
He did, stating simply, "We would have liked to have more." But without that core commitment to curb fossil fuels, the UN Secretary General has warned that the goal of limiting warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius established in Paris now seems almost certain to fail.
They did achieve some limited progress, though.
Some, yes. Agreements were made on efforts to triple funding by 2035 to help poor countries adapt to the inevitable effects of climate change. And they agreed to open discussions on climate-related trade issues, like the tariffs that are currently snarling the sale of solar panels and electric vehicles internationally.
But those achievements feel really minor compared to the main objective of addressing the source of the warming itself.
They do. Shifting back to domestic environmental safety, the EPA is moving in a concerning direction on chemical regulation. They've approved new PFAS pesticides. These are the notorious forever chemicals linked to cancer, birth defects, and damage to the liver and immune system.
And critics are issuing severe warnings that this decision will expose significantly more Americans to these chemicals through our food supply.
For context, the Environmental Working Group previously found that nearly 15 million pounds of PFAS pesticides were sprayed on crops in California alone between 2018 and 2023. This is a massive issue of long-term public health risk.
What makes this regulatory decision particularly alarming is the sheer lack of institutional consistency within the EPA itself. It just highlights this bureaucratic dysfunction.
Totally. The EPA's Office of Pollution Prevention and Toxics has adopted a limited scientific definition of PFAS as compounds with two or more fluorinated carbon atoms. But the Office of Pesticide Programs, which is the office making these approvals, has adopted no standardized definition of PFAS. They're choosing instead to evaluate each substance individually.
So one arm of the EPA is recognizing the danger and defining the chemical threat, while the other arm, responsible for approving what goes onto our food, is operating without that essential scientific framework.
It's a stark contrast to the previous administration, which deliberately deprioritized these applications due to profound concerns about persistence in the environment and accumulation in the human body.
And what's the current EPA's defense?
A spokeswoman cited the unique benefits for farmers and dismissed criticism as just another example of partisan organizations peddling mistruths.
But when you have former high-level officials saying there was a deliberate decision to spend resources elsewhere because of worries about irreversible harm,
it suggests the current policy is a sharp pivot prioritizing industry over environmental persistence concerns.
Okay, moving from policy to public opinion, there's a fascinating Washington Post Ipsos poll that reveals how Americans feel about the ultra-wealthy directly influencing elections.
It found a clear and strong majority, 58% of Americans dislike billionaires spending large amounts of money on elections. And what's notable is how broad this disapproval is. It includes 75% of Democrats, 60% of independents, and even 42% of Republicans. This is a rare area of widespread political agreement.
And when asked about the overall impact of billionaires on society, the findings are even more bleak for the ultra-wealthy.
Yeah, only 12% of respondents said billionaires have a positive impact. And this sentiment aligns with other recent surveys that show most Americans believe billionaires pose a tangible threat to democracy, and that about 7 in 10 feel the very wealthy wield too much influence over the White House.
And the data provides the context for this concern.
It does. Political giving by the richest 100 Americans has surged nearly 140-fold since the year 2000.
140-fold.
That astronomical increase illustrates precisely why the public perceives the soaring influence of ultra-wealth in political giving as fundamentally destabilizing to the democratic process.
Now, we need to shift into a very specific and arcane corner of finance that is quietly having a massive dilutive impact on retail investors. The rise of ATM transactions.
And this is not the cash machine you use on the corner. ATM here stands for at the market. It's a mechanism where publicly traded companies quietly sell new shares, sometimes in small amounts, sometimes in large, whenever they choose. It's been described as dribbling out stock.
And scale of this quiet stock selling is genuinely eye-opening.
$335 billion has been raised via ATM sales since 2020. The volume is sharply up this year, on track for the highest volume ever, and it's being used heavily by companies popular with retail investors, including those so-called meme stocks.
The profound concern here is the opacity, which gets back to that central theme of our deep dive. What is being hidden?
Exactly. Yeah. The required disclosure that a company has sold stock via an ATM only happens after the fact, in quarterly financial statements.
So it's already happened by the time you find out.
Right. A hedge fund trader called this arrangement soft inside information. And here's why that's critical. Management knows exactly when the selling is occurring. Sophisticated investors, or those favored by the company, can negotiate discounted prices or use that internal knowledge to structure other trades and profit before the full dilution becomes publicly clear.
This mechanism acts as a silent stealth tax on retail investors.
It does. For the average person, the risk is dilution, the shrinking of your ownership stake. Because the sales happen incrementally, it's extremely difficult for a small investor to track how much their ownership is silently diminishing.
And the source cited some dramatic examples.
It did. Examples of companies whose share count effectively doubled, meaning original investors now own half as much of the company without ever selling a single share.
So the implication here is pretty clear.
Very clear. At a time when President Trump and other policymakers are talking about reducing regulation and disclosure requirements for publicly traded companies, the immense use of opaque mechanisms like ATM sales confirms that the less information available, the more sophisticated, well-connected players benefit at the expense of everyone else.
Okay, pivoting from finance to the political future, Democrats are apparently banking heavily on the historical pattern known as the six-year itch, to potentially favor them in the 2026 Senate races.
Right, the six-year itch. It's a political pattern borrowed from marriage experts. The sixth year of a presidency historically produces brutal midterm results for the president's party. Since 1958, Bill Clinton is the only president who managed to avoid significant Senate losses in his sixth year.
So Democratic strategists are seeing parallels to the factors that doomed previous administrations in years 5 and 6.
They are. They point specifically to legislative overreach, citing the massive domestic policy bill financed by cuts to entitlement programs like Medicaid. A lame duck president focused on legacy wins, swirling corruption allegations, and critically severe voter concern over affordability.
And this affordability crisis is a massive brewing factor.
Huge. GOP strategists themselves are sounding warnings about Trump's apparently lackadaisical approach to the cost of living. David Winston, a key GOP pollster, stated plainly that when families are paying the price for hamburger that they used to pay for steak, there's a problem.
So if these historical factors, affordability concerns, institutional corruption, and legislative overreach all combine,
even Trump's unconventional political style might not insulate the GOP from losing their narrow path toward maintaining a Senate majority.
It's just fascinating to see political strategists clinging to historical patterns, even in an era that's defined by breaking norms. And that observation brings us logically to our final segment, looking at society, culture, and some necessary everyday life advice.
And we continue to see this pronounced paradox of the tech economy reflected sharply in regional inequality, particularly in the San Francisco Bay Area, which is, you know, synonymous with tech billionaires and immense capital.
The data here is just staggering.
It is. The Bay Area's poverty rate is rising significantly for the first time in over a decade. It's jumped by more than 4% in less than a year. And this spike drastically outpaced the statewide increase. We're talking about over a million residents now living in poverty. That's defined as an income of about $28,000 or less per year for a single adult.
And the underlying economic analysis shows the core problem is this radical mismatch between wages and costs.
Right. While average income for some went up by about 10% from 2021 to 2023, the cost of living soared by nearly twice that amount. And this crisis is compounded by the expiration of crucial pandemic safety nets, like the federal child tax credit and expanded unemployment benefits.
To illustrate the human toll, there's the example of Tazo Stewart Riascos.
Yeah. He works multiple jobs, logging an incredible 28,000 steps daily just to maintain stability. He spends two-thirds of his monthly income, an insane proportion, on rent. It leads him to feel permanently stuck in survival mode, unable to prioritize basics like exercise, healthy eating, or even nurturing relationships.
And this contrast is even sharper when we look at the tech giants themselves. You have companies like Meta, Microsoft, and Amazon slashing jobs despite announcing soaring revenue.
And this paradox is driven by a forward-looking strategy. CEOs are preparing for an era where AI boosts productivity. This means maintaining a lean headcount and shifting resources aggressively toward AI-focused roles rather than existing staff.
So the anxiety among tech workers who are long accustomed to highly secure, high-paying jobs, it's palpable.
Very. One former Microsoft product manager noted that hearing about cuts became regular lunchtime fodder. Economists believe the overall level of tech employment will remain under intense pressure as these large companies essentially create the playbook for how other industries will follow regarding mass AI integration.
With all of this focus on technology and data, we have to address personal security because data breaches are now, well, they're not just a possibility, they're a certainty.
That's right. The Identity Theft Resource Center reported 3,158 data compromises in 2024. That's a 211% increase from the prior year.
Okay, so what is the essential proactive step you must take upon receiving a data breach notice?
It's immediate and decisive action. You need to immediately place a security freeze on your credit files at all three bureaus, Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion.
And we stress security freeze because it is much stronger than a simple fraud alert.
Much stronger. A fraud alert only prompts lenders to verify your identity. A security freeze is a literal roadblock. It prevents the bureaus from releasing your credit file to anyone without your explicit personal permission. It is the single best preventative measure.
And you should also take advantage of the recently made permanent extension of free weekly credit reports to monitor your accounts line by line for any unauthorized transactions.
Right. And on a more positive technological note, we have some advice for what to do with that drawer full of aging hardware you might have lying around.
Instead of letting it gather dust, or worse, tossing it in the trash, donate it. Nonprofits across the country are eager to take old desktops, laptops, and tablets.
Exactly. Organizations like CompuDopt, PCs for People, and Human IT specialize in refurbishing this equipment. CompuDopt, for instance, provides free computers, complete with 2 years of technical support, to qualifying disadvantaged families.
And any donated devices that are beyond repair.
They're ethically harvested for parts, sold to fund operations, or recycled responsibly. It creates this sustainable loop that helps bridge the digital divide.
Okay, let's shift now to culture. and the immense gravitational pull of the Korean Wave, or Hallyu, on mainstream American institutions. The Smithsonian National Museum of Asian Art is hosting a major exhibition, Korean Treasures, specifically capitalizing on the global Korean Wave, K-pop, K-drama, K-beauty.
And what makes this exhibition a deep dive in its own right is the curatorial goal. They're not just riding the pop culture trend. They want to demonstrate the deep wellsprings of creativity in Korean culture that feed the current global phenomenon.
The director called it the biggest thing that's going to happen this decade in Korean art history in North America.
And they expect the show to intentionally draw a much younger crowd than typical art exhibitions.
A powerful, specific example of this cultural depth is the Sun, Moon, and Five Peaks painting.
Right, this iconic image, which historically symbolized the king's omnipresent authority during the Joseon era, is now a prominent backdrop to modern aesthetics. It even appeared in a current film, K-pop Demon Hunters. So the exhibition draws this direct, tangible line from centuries of tradition to today's massive global influence.
We also get a fascinating glimpse into the evolution of visual arts and modern music through the long-standing collaboration between Radiohead's Thom Yorke and the artist Stanley Donwood.
Yeah, their joint work is currently on display in their hometown of Oxford.
And their process is what makes it unique and conceptually interesting.
It is. The visuals are created during the album process, not after the music is finished. They work in a shared space beside the recording studio, and the visual mood and texture often feed back into the music York takes into the studio.
So the artwork is a co-creator of the sound, not just a complement to it.
Exactly, and the evolution of their technique is particularly telling in our current time. The show traces a shift from their reliance on early digital media to later works handmade using physical materials like oil paint, gold leaf, and found objects.
Which is seen as an intentional aesthetic resistance against the perceived threat of pervasive AI and digitization.
Right. It's emphasizing the tactile, iterative power of handmade creation as a way to remain resistant to synthetic output.
Okay, turning to sports, the Washington Commanders are facing a true, painful test of their organizational culture under coach Dan Quinn after a grueling 6-game losing streak that has dropped them to a 3-8 record.
Yeah, and Quinn, who is known specifically as a culture builder, has maintained that while the losses are difficult, hardship is where a team's culture truly reveals its structural integrity. A long losing streak either exposes fatal fissures or ideally provides positive glimpses of what he calls sideways accountability, where teammates hold each other to a shared standard without relying only on the coaching staff.
And meanwhile, in Kansas City, the once sturdy Chiefs find themselves in a surprisingly precarious spot at 5-5.
They do. Despite 7 straight AFC championship appearances since Patrick Mahomes took over, a loss this Sunday would drop their playoff chances to a concerning 35%.
And their struggles pronounced when they're away from Arrowhead Stadium.
It really is. While they score regularly at home, their red zone efficiency plummets drastically from 73.9% at home to just 55.6% on the road. And interestingly, Coach Andy Reid subtly intimated this week that Mahomes himself has something to do with the decreased run game, suggesting maybe some friction or frustration about the offensive strategy. They're running the ball less than almost any other team in the league.
Finally, let's turn to the advice and consumer notes section, starting with a classic workplace conundrum, being an involuntary buffer between a prickly territorial supervisor and the rest of your coworkers.
This is a highly relatable dilemma. The reader's supervisor is territorial and ignores direct owner instructions, like addressing issues to managers instead of low-level employees. And coworkers, who are desperate for clarity, come to the reader for accurate explanations.
So the advice centers on maintaining strict professional neutrality and effectiveness.
Exactly. The core solution is to be a friendly, non-judgmental resource for coworkers, focusing purely on providing accurate answers. And crucially, when the supervisor seeks validation, the reader should use non-judgmental language that subtly reinforces official protocol.
So something like, didn't the owner say we should pass corrections along to the manager? I'm happy to make sure that gets handled for you.
Precisely. It protects the reader from confrontation while gently pushing the supervisor back toward compliance.
We also got a holiday conflict dilemma from a reader who identifies as libertarian and is just tired of attending family gatherings dominated by what they describe as over-the-top political bashing of former President Trump. If they don't chime in, they're immediately accused of being a supporter.
And the advice here is all about boundary setting and self-protection. The suggestion is to start with a calm, preemptive phone call to the family organizer, maybe a cousin, and state that you deeply value the family time, but find the political debate detracts from the season, and you'd like to respectfully request setting politics aside for the day.
And if that fails?
If that fails, the advice validates the reader's right to choose to avoid the suffering entirely, a choice the reader who is planning to skip their in-laws' holidays has already made. It's entirely reasonable if boundaries aren't respected.
And finally, since Thanksgiving is rapidly approaching, we have some crucial cooking advice, specifically tackling the two most stressful dishes, the turkey and the pie crusts.
Okay, for a juicy, moist turkey, the number one rule is counterintuitive and science-based. Stop basting.
Stop basting.
Stop basting. Scientific evidence shows it's ineffective. The moisture doesn't penetrate the skin. Plus, repeatedly opening the oven door prolongs the cooking time, which significantly increases the risk of dry, overcooked meat.
So the real secret is precision temperature control.
It is. Invest in a quality digital probe thermometer. While the USDA suggests 165 degrees Fahrenheit, many chefs aim for a slightly lower target of 150 degrees in the breast. Maintaining that temperature for about 4 minutes to ensure bacterial risk is eliminated while maximizing juiciness.
And dark meat needs to be cooked higher.
Right, to 175 or higher. And remember that critical resting time? Rest the bird for at least 30 minutes without tenting it tightly. It allows the juices to redistribute and prevents massive moisture loss when you slice it.
Okay, and for pie crusts, the goal is conquering the dreaded soggy bottom. You have to know the difference between par baking and blind baking.
You do. Par baking is partially baking the crust. It's essential for single crust pies where the filling cooks much faster than the dough, like pumpkin pie. It ensures the crust gets a head start and isn't raw.
And blind baking.
Blind baking means the crust is fully baked before the filling is added. That's necessary for any no-bake fillings, like cream pies, where the filling is just chilled.
And a pro tip for using pie weights.
It is critical that they reach all the way up the sides of the pan. That's what prevents the crust from slumping and shrinking down during the baking process.
What an exhaustive dive into this incredible amount of material. We've moved from the executive branch's legal audacity in using classified OLC memos to justify lethal strikes, essentially waging a new undeclared war, all the way to the domestic institutional fight over constitutional norms.
Exactly. We tracked the stunning failure of the Comey prosecution over basic constitutional procedure, the threat to congressional immunity in the MacGyver case, and the quiet, intentional use of administrative power denying FEMA relief, threatening TPS as a tool of political punishment.
And on the financial front, we saw how capital continues to influence policy and how information is intentionally obscured. The failure of global leaders to curtail fossil fuels at COP30 benefits powerful energy interests, just as the quiet, incremental dilution of investor ownership through opaque ATM stock sales benefits sophisticated shareholders at the expense of everyone else.
And underlying all of these stories is that constant defining tension between transparency and intentional opacity. We've seen the powerful consistently striving for secrecy, whether it's classified OLC memos, justifying lethal force, grand jury testimony shrouded in decades of secrecy, or undisclosed ATM dilution affecting everyday investors.
Which raises an important and, I think, provocative question for you, the listener. In a world defined by this immense information overload, the greatest challenge is often not discerning what is being reported, but what is actively being hidden, manipulated, or strategically delayed for political or financial advantage. As you look across your own spheres of interest, whether it's the fine print of a corporate announcement, the nuances of local policy, or even the subtle dynamics in your own workplace, what hidden stories should you be searching for that aren't on the front page?
That's the real deep dive waiting to happen.
Thank you so much for expertly guiding us through the comprehensive Washington Post edition today.
A pleasure, as always.
And thank you for joining us for the deep dive. We'll talk soon.